atheist probably thinks that in death he'll get some answer. I mean, God will be there, or there won't be anything at all. But that's just it, I said. We don't make any discovery at that moment. We merely stop. We pass into non-existence without ever knowing a thing. I saw the universe, a vision of the sun, the planets, the stars, black night going on forever, and I began to laugh. Do you realize that? We'll never know why the hell any of it happened, not even when it's over, I shouted at Nicholas, who was sitting back on the bed, nodding and drinking his wine out of a flagon. We're going to die and not even know. We'll never know, and all this meaninglessness will just go on and on and on, and we won't any longer be witnesses to it. We won't have even that little bit of power to give meaning to it in our minds. We'll just be gone, dead, 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 without ever knowing. But I had stopped laughing. I stood still, and I understood perfectly what I was saying. There was no judgment day, no final explanation, no luminous moment in which all terrible wrongs would be made right, all horrors redeemed. The witches burnt at the stake would never be avenged. No one was ever going to tell us anything. No, I didn't understand it at this moment. I saw it, and I began to make the single sound. Oh, I said it again. Oh, and then I said it louder and louder and louder, and dropped the wine bottle on the floor. I put my hands to my head, and I kept saying it, and I could see my mouth opened in that perfect circle that I had described to my mother, and I kept saying, oh, oh, oh. I said it like a great hiccuping that I couldn't stop, and Nicholas took hold of me and started shaking me, saying, Lestat, stop. I couldn't stop. I ran to the window, unlatched it, and swung out the heavy little glass and stared at the stars. I couldn't stand seeing them. I couldn't stand seeing the pure emptiness, the silence, the absolute absence of any answer, and I started roaring as Nicholas pulled me back from the windowsill and pulled shut the glass. You'll be all right, he said over and over. Someone was beating on the door. It was the innkeeper, demanding why we had to carry on like this. You'll feel all right in the morning, Nicholas kept insisting. You just have to sleep. We had awakened everyone. I couldn't be quiet. I kept making the same sound over again, and I ran out of the inn with Nicholas behind me and down the street of the village and up towards the castle with Nicholas trying to catch up with me, and through the gates and up into my room. Sleep. That's what you need, he kept saying to me desperately. I was lying against the wall with my hands over my ears, and that sound kept coming. Oh, oh, oh! In the morning, he said, it will be better. Well, it was not better in the morning, and it was no better by nightfall, and in fact it got worse with the coming of the darkness. I walked and talked and gestured like a contented human being, but I was flayed. I was shuddering. My teeth were chattering. I couldn't stop it. I was staring at everything around me in horror. The darkness terrified me. The sight of the old suits of armor in the hall terrified me. I stared at the mace and the flail I'd taken out after the wolves. I stared at the faces of my brothers. I stared at everything, seeing behind every configuration of color and light and shadow the same thing, death. Only it wasn't just death as I'd thought of it before. It was death the way I saw it now. Real death, total death, inevitable, irreversible, and resolving nothing. And in this unbearable state of agitation, I commenced to do something I'd never done before. I turned to those around me and questioned them relentlessly. But do you believe in God? I asked my brother Augustin. How can you live if you don't? But do you really believe in anything? I demanded of my blind father. If you knew you were dying at this very minute, would you expect to see God or darkness? Tell me. You're mad. You've always been mad, he shouted. Get out of this house. You'll drive us all crazy. He stood up, which was hard for him, being crippled and blind, and he tried to throw his goblet at me, and naturally he missed. I couldn't look at my mother. I couldn't be near her. I didn't want to make her suffer with my questions. I went down to the inn. I couldn't bear to think of the witch's place. I would not have walked to that end of the village for anything. I put my hands over my ears and shut my eyes. "Go away," I said at the thought of those who died like that, without ever, ever understanding anything. The second day was no better, and it wasn't any better by the end of the week, either. I ate, drank, slept, but every waking moment was pure panic and pure pain. I went to the village priest and demanded did he really believe the body of Christ was present on the altar at the consecration? And after hearing his stammered answers and seeing the fear in his eyes, I went away more desperate than before. But how do you live? How do you go on breathing and moving and doing things when you know there is no explanation? I was raving finally. And then Nicholas said maybe the music would make me feel better. He would play the violin. I was afraid of the intensity of it. But we went to the orchard, and in the sunshine Nicholas played every song he knew. I sat there with my arms folded and my knees drawn up, my teeth chattering, though we were right in the hot sun, and the sun was glaring off the little polished violin, and I watched Nicholas swaying into the music as he stood before me, the raw, pure sounds swelling magically to fill the orchard and the valley, though it wasn't magic. And Nicholas put his arms around me finally, and we just sat there silent. And then he said very softly, "Lestat, believe me, this will pass." "Play again," I said. "The music is innocent." Nicholas smiled and nodded. "Pamper the madman." And I knew it wasn't going to pass, and nothing for the moment could make me forget. But what I felt was inexpressible gratitude for the music, that in this horror there could be something as beautiful as that. You couldn't understand anything, and you couldn't change anything, but you could make music like that. And I felt the same gratitude when I saw the village children dancing, when I saw their arms raised and their knees bent and their bodies turning to the rhythm of the songs they sang. I started to cry watching them. I wandered into the church, and on my knees I leaned against the wall, and I looked at the ancient statues, and I felt the same gratitude looking at the finely carved fingers, and the noses, and the ears, and the expressions on their faces, and the deep folds in their garments, and I couldn't stop myself from crying. "At least we had these beautiful things," I said. "Such goodness!" But nothing natural seemed beautiful to me now. The very sight of a great tree standing alone in a field could make me tremble and cry out, "Fill the orchard with music!" And let me tell you a little secret. It never did pass, really. 6. What caused it? Was it the late-night drinking and talking? Or did it have to do with my mother and her saying she was going to die? Did the wolves have something to do with it? Was it a spell cast upon the imagination by the witch's place? I don't know. It had come like something visited upon me from outside. One minute it was an idea, and the next it was real. I think you can invite that sort of thing, but you can't make it come. Of course it was to slacken, but the sky was never quite the same shade of blue again. I mean, the world looked different forever after, and even in moments of exquisite happiness there was the darkness lurking, the sense of our frailty and our hopelessness. Maybe it was a presentiment. But I don't think so. It was more important than that, and frankly I don't believe in presentiments. But to return to the story. During all this misery, I kept away from my mother. I wasn't going to say these monstrous things about death and chaos to her. But she heard from everyone else that I'd lost my reason. And finally, on the first Sunday night of Lent, she came to me. I was alone in my room, and the whole household had gone down to the village at twilight for the big bonfire that was the custom every year on this evening. I had always hated the celebration. It had a ghastly aspect to it. The roaring flames, the dancing and singing, the peasants going afterwards through the orchards with their torches to the tune of their strange chanting. We had had a priest for a little while who called it pagan, but they got rid of him fast enough. The farmers of our mountains kept to their old rituals. It was to make the trees bear and the crops grow, all this, and on this occasion more than any other I felt I saw the kind of men and women who could burn witches. In my present frame of mind it struck terror. I sat by my own little fire, trying to resist the urge to go to the window and look down on the big fire that drew me as strongly as it scared me. My mother came in, closed the door behind her, and told me that she must talk to me. Her whole manner was tenderness. "Is it on account of my dying? What's come over you?" she asked. "Tell me if it is, and put your hands in mine." She even kissed me. She was frail in her faded dressing gown, and her hair was undone. I couldn't stand to see the streaks of grey in it. She looked starved. But I told her the truth. I didn't know, and then I explained some of what had happened in the inn. I tried not to convey the horror of it, the strange logic of it. I tried not to make it so absolute. She listened, and then she said, "You're such a fighter, my son. You never accept, not even when it's the fate of all mankind will you accept it." "I can't," I said miserably. "I love you for it," she said. "It's all too like you that you should see this in a tiny bedroom in the inn late at night when you're drinking wine, and it's entirely like you to rage against it the way you rage against everything else." I started to cry again, though I knew she wasn't condemning me, and then she took out a handkerchief and opened it to reveal several gold coins. "You'll get over this," she said. "For the moment, death is spoiling life for you, that's all. But life is more important than death. You'll realize it soon enough. Now listen to what I have to say. I've had the doctor here, and the old woman in the village who knows more about healing than he knows. Both agree with me I won't live too long." "Stop, mother," I said, aware of how selfish I was being, but unable to hold back. "And this time there'll be no gifts. Put the money away." "Sit down," she said. She pointed to the bench near the hearth. Reluctantly I did as I was told. She sat beside me. "I know," she said, "that you and Nicholas are talking of running away."
"I won't go, mother."
"What, until I'm dead?" I didn't answer her. I can't convey to you the frame of mind. I was still raw, trembling. And we had to talk about the fact that this living, breathing woman was going to stop living and breathing and start to putrefy and rot away, that her soul would spin into an abyss, that everything she had suffered in life, including the end of it, would come to nothing at all. Her little face was like something painted on a veil, and from the distant village came the thinnest sound of the singing villagers. "I want you to go to Paris, Lestat," she said. "I want you to take this money, which is all I have left from my family. I want to know you're in Paris, Lestat, when my time comes. I want to die knowing you are in Paris." I was startled. I remembered her stricken expression years ago when they'd brought me back from the Italian troop. I looked at her for a long moment. She sounded almost angry in her persuasiveness. "I'm terrified of dying," she said. Her voice went almost dry. "And I swear I will go mad if I don't know you're in Paris and you're free when it finally comes." I questioned her with my eyes. I was asking her with my eyes, "Do you really mean this?" "I have kept you here as surely as your father has," she said, "not on account of pride, but on account of selfishness, and now I'm going to atone for it. I'll see you go, and I don't care what you do when you reach Paris, whether you sing while Nicholas plays the violin or turn somersaults on the stage at the Saint-Germain Fair, but go, and do what you will do as best you can." I tried to take her in my arms. She stiffened at first, but then I felt her weaken, and she melted against me, and she gave herself so completely to me in that moment that I think I understood why she had always been so restrained. She cried, which I'd never heard her do, and I loved this moment for all its pain. I was ashamed of loving it, but I wouldn't let her go. I held her tightly, and maybe kissed her for all the times she'd never let me do it. We seemed, for the moment, like two parts of the same thing. And then she grew calm. She seemed to settle into herself, and slowly but very firmly she released me and pushed me away. She talked for a long time. She said things I didn't understand then, about how, when she would see me riding out to hunt, she felt some wondrous pleasure in it, and she felt that same pleasure when I angered everyone and thundered my questions at my father and brothers as to why we had to live the way we lived. She spoke in an almost eerie way of my being a secret part of her anatomy, of my being the organ for her which women do not really have. "You are the man in me," she said, "and so I've kept you here, afraid of living without you, and maybe now in sending you away I am only doing what I have done before." She shocked me a little. I never thought a woman could feel or articulate anything quite like this. "Nicholas's father knows about your plans," she said. "The innkeeper overheard you. It's important you leave right away. Take the diligence at dawn and write to me as soon as you reach Paris. There are letter writers at the cemetery of Les Innocents near the Saint-Germain Market. Find one who can write Italian for you, and then no one will be able to read the letter but me." When she left the room, I didn't quite believe what had happened. For a long moment I stood staring before me. I stared at my bed with its mattress of straw, at the two coats I owned and the red cloak, and my one pair of leather shoes by the hearth. I stared out the narrow slit of a window at the black hulk of the mountains I'd known all my life. The darkness, the gloom, slid back from me for a precious moment. And then I was rushing down the stairs and down the mountain to the village to find Nicholas and to tell him we were going to Paris. We were going to do it. Nothing could stop us this time. He was with his family, watching the bonfire. And as soon as he saw me, he threw his arm around my neck, and I hooked my arm around his waist, and I dragged him away from the crowds and the blaze, and towards the end of the meadow. The air smelled fresh and green as it does only in spring. Even the villagers' singing didn't sound so horrible. I started dancing around in a circle. "Get your violin," I said. "Play a song about going to Paris. We're on our way. We're going in the morning." "And how are we going to feed ourselves in Paris?" he sang out, as he made with his empty hands to play an invisible violin. "Are you going to shoot rats for our supper?" "Don't ask what we'll do when we get there," I said. "The important thing is just to get there." 7. Not even a fortnight passed before I stood in the midst of the noonday crowds in the vast public cemetery of Les Innocents, with its old vaults and stinking open graves, the most fantastical marketplace I'd ever beheld, and amid the stench and the noise bent over an Italian letter writer dictating my first letter to my mother. Yes, we had arrived safely after travelling day and night, and we had rooms in the Ile de la Cité, and we were inexpressibly happy, and Paris was warm and beautiful and magnificent beyond all imagining. I wished I could have taken the pen myself and written to her. I wished I could have told her what it was like, seeing these towering mansions, ancient winding streets aswarm with beggars, peddlers, noblemen, houses of 4 and 5 stories banking the crowded boulevards. I wished I could have described the carriages to her, the rumbling confections of gilt and glass bullying their way over the Pont Neuf and the Pont Notre-Dame, streaming past the Louvre, the Palais Royal. I wished I could describe the people, the gentlemen with their clocked stockings and silver walking sticks, tripping through the mud in pastel slippers, the ladies with their pearl-encrusted wigs and swaying panniers of silk and muslin, my first certain glimpse of Queen Marie Antoinette herself, walking boldly through the gardens of the Tuileries. Of course, she'd seen it all years and years before I was born. She'd lived in Naples and London and Rome with her father. But I wanted to tell her what she had given to me, how it was to hear the choir in Notre Dame, to push into the jam-packed cafes with Nicholas, talk with his old student cronies over English coffee, what it was like to get dressed up in Nicholas's fine clothes. He made me do it, and stand below the footlights of the Comédie Française, gazing up in adoration at the actors on the stage. But all I wrote in this letter was perhaps the very best of it, the address of the garret rooms we called our home in the Ile de la Cité, and the news. I have been hired in a real theatre to study as an actor, with a fine prospect of performing very soon. What I didn't tell her was that we had to walk up 6 flights of stairs to our rooms, that men and women brawled and screamed in the alleyways beneath our windows, that we had run out of money already, thanks to my dragging us to every opera, ballet, and drama in town, and that the establishment where I worked was a shabby little boulevard theatre, one step up from a platform at the fair, and my jobs were to help the players dress, sell tickets, sweep up and throw out the troublemakers. But I was in paradise again, and so was Nicholas, though no decent orchestra in the city would hire him, and he was now playing solos with a little bunch of musicians in the theatre where I worked, and when we were really pinched he did play right on the boulevard, with me beside him holding out the hat. We were shameless. We ran up the steps each night with our bottle of cheap wine and a loaf of fine, sweet Parisian bread, which was ambrosia after what we'd eaten in the Auvergne. And in the light of our one tallow candle, the garret was the most glorious place I'd ever inhabited. As I mentioned before, I'd seldom been in a little wooden room except in the inn. Well, this room had plaster walls and a plaster ceiling. It was really Paris. It had polished wood flooring, and even a tiny little fireplace with a new chimney which actually made a draught. So what if we had to sleep on lumpy pallets, and the neighbors woke us up fighting? We were waking up in Paris, and could roam arm in arm for hours through streets and alleyways, peering into shops full of jewelry and plate, tapestries and statues, wealth such as I'd never seen. Even the reeking meat markets delighted me. The crash and clatter of the city, the tireless busyness of its thousands upon thousands of laborers, clerks, craftsmen, the comings and goings of an endless multitude. By day I almost forgot the vision of the inn and the darkness. Unless, of course, I glimpsed some uncollected corpse in a filthy alleyway, of which there were many, or I happened upon a public execution in the Place de Grève. And I was always happening upon a public execution in the Place de Grève. I'd wander out of the square, shuddering, almost moaning. I could become obsessed with it, if not distracted. But Nicholas was adamant. Lestat, no talk of the eternal, the immutable, the unknowable. He threatened to hit me or shake me if I should start. And when twilight came on, at the time I hated more than ever, whether I had seen an execution or not, whether the day had been glorious or vexing, the trembling would start in me, and only one thing saved me from it, the warmth and excitement of the brightly lighted theatre. And I made sure that before dusk I was safely inside. Now, in the Paris of those times, the theatres of the boulevards weren't even legitimate houses at all. Only the Comédie Française and the Théâtre des Italiens were government-sanctioned theatres, and to them all serious drama belonged. This included tragedy as well as comedy, the plays of Racine, Corneille, and a brilliant Voltaire. But the old Italian commedia that I loved, Pantaloon, Harlequin, Scaramouche, and the rest, lived on as they always had, with tightrope walkers, acrobats, jugglers, and puppeteers, in the platform spectacles at the Saint-Germain and the Saint-Laurent fairs. And the boulevard theatres had grown out of these fairs. By my time, the last decades of the 18th century, they were permanent establishments along the Boulevard du Temple. And though they played to the poor who couldn't afford the grand houses, they also collected a very well-to-do crowd. Plenty of the aristocracy and the rich bourgeoisie crowded into the loge to see the boulevard performances, because they were lively and full of good talent, and not so stiff as the plays of the great Racine or the great Voltaire. We did the Italian comedy just as I'd learned it before, full of improvisation, so that every night it was new and different, yet always the same. And we also did singing, and all kinds of nonsense, not just because the people loved it, but because we had to. We couldn't be accused of breaking the monopoly of the state theatres on straight plays. The house itself was a rickety wooden rat-trap, seating no more than 300, but its little stage and props were elegant. It had a luxurious blue velvet stage curtain, and its private boxes had screens. And its actors and actresses were seasoned and truly talented, or so it seemed to me. Even if I hadn't had this newly acquired dread of the dark, this malady of mortality, as Nicholas persisted in calling it, it couldn't have been more exciting to go through that stage door. For 5 to 6 hours every evening I lived and breathed in a little universe of shouting and laughing and quarrelling men and women, struggling for this one and against that one, all of us comrades in the wings, even if we weren't friends. Maybe it was like being in a little boat on the ocean, all of us pulling together, unable to escape each other. It was divine. Nicholas was slightly less enthusiastic. But then that was to be expected. And he got even more ironical when his rich student friends came around to talk to him. They thought he was a lunatic to live as he did. And for me, a nobleman shoveling actresses into their costumes and emptying slop buckets, they had not words at all. Of course, all that these young bourgeois really wanted was to be aristocrats. They bought titles, married into aristocratic families whenever they could. And it's one of the little jokes of history that they got mixed up in the revolution and helped to abolish the class which, in fact, they really wanted to join. I didn't care if we ever saw Nicholas's friends again. The actors didn't know about my family, and in favour of the very simple Lestat de Valois, which meant nothing actually, I dropped my real name, de Liancourt. I was learning everything I could about the stage. I memorised. I mimicked. I asked endless questions, and only stopped my education long enough each night for that moment when Nicholas played his solo on the violin. He'd rise from his seat in the tiny orchestra. The spotlight would pick him out from the others, and he would rip into a little sonata, sweet enough and just short enough to bring down the house. And all the while I dreamed of my own moment, when the old actors, whom I studied and pestered and imitated and waited upon like a lackey, would finally say, "All right, Lestat, tonight we need you as Lelio. Now you ought to know what to do." It came in late August at last. Paris was at its warmest, and the nights were almost balmy, and the house was full of restless audience fanning itself with handkerchiefs and handbills. The thick white paint was melting on my face as I put it on. I wore a pasteboard sword with Nicholas's best velvet coat, and I was trembling before I stepped on the stage, thinking, "This is like waiting to be executed or something." But as soon as I stepped out there, I turned and looked directly into the jam-packed hall, and the strangest thing happened. The fear evaporated. I beamed at the audience, and very slowly I bowed. I stared at the lovely Flaminia, as if I was seeing her for the first time. I had to win her. The romp began. The stage belonged to me as it had years and years ago in that far-off country town, and as we pranced madly together across the boards, quarrelling, embracing, clowning, laughter rocked the house. I could feel the attention as if it were an embrace. Each gesture, each line brought a roar from the audience. It was too easy, almost, and we could have worked it for another half-hour if the other actors, eager to get into the next trick, as they called it, hadn't forced us finally towards the wings. The crowd was standing up to applaud us, and it wasn't that country audience under the open sky. These were Parisians, shouting for Lelio and Flaminia to come back out. In the shadows of the wings I reeled. I almost collapsed. I could not see anything for the moment but the vision of the audience gazing up at me over the footlights. I wanted to go right back on stage. I grabbed Flaminia and kissed her and realized that she was kissing me back, passionately. Then Renaud, the old manager, pulled her away. "All right, Lestat," he said, as if he were cross about something. "All right, you've done tolerably well. I'm going to let you go on regularly from now on." But before I could start jumping up and down for joy, half the troupe materialized around us, and Lucina, one of the actresses, immediately spoke up. "Oh, no, you'll not let him go on regularly," she said. "He's the handsomest actor on the Boulevard du Temple, and you'll hire him outright for it, and pay him outright for it, and he doesn't touch another broom or mop. I was terrified. My career had just started, and it was about to be over. But to my amazement, Renaud agreed to all her terms. Of course, I was very flattered to be called handsome, and I understood, as I had years ago, that Lelio, the lover, is supposed to have considerable style. An aristocrat, with any breeding whatsoever, was perfect for the part. But if I was going to make the Paris audiences really notice me, if I was going to have them talking about me at the Comédie Française, I had to be more than some yellow-haired angel fallen out of a marquis's family onto the stage. I had to be a great actor. And that is exactly what I determined to be. That night, Nicholas and I celebrated with a colossal drunk. We had all the troupe up to our rooms for it, and I climbed out on the slippery rooftops and opened my arms to Paris, and Nicholas played his violin in the window until we'd awakened the whole neighborhood. The music was rapturous, yet people were snarling and screaming up the alleyways and banging on pots and pans. We paid no attention. We were dancing and singing as we had in the witch's place. I almost fell off the window ledge. The next day, bottle in hand, I dictated the whole story to the Italian letter-writer in the stinking sunshine in Les Innocents, and saw that the letter went off to my mother at once. I wanted to embrace everybody I saw in the streets. I was Lelio. I was an actor. By September I had my name on the handbills, and I sent those to my mother, too. And we weren't doing the old Commedia. We were performing a farce by a famous writer who, on account of a general playwright's strike, couldn't get it performed at the Comédie Française. Of course, we couldn't say his name, but everyone knew it was his work, and half the court was packing Renaud's house of thespians every night. I wasn't the lead, but I was the young lover, a sort of Lelio again, really, which was almost better than the lead, and I stole every scene in which I appeared. Nicholas had taught me the part, bawling me out constantly for not learning to read. And by the fourth performance, the playwright had written extra lines for me. Nicky was having his own moment at the intermezzo, when his latest rendering of a frothy little Mozart sonata was keeping the house in its seats. Even his student friends were back. We were getting invitations to private balls. I went tearing off to Les Innocents every few days to write to my mother. And finally I had a clipping from an English paper, The Spectator, to send her, which praised our little play, and in particular the blonde-haired rogue who steals the hearts of the ladies in the third and fourth acts. Of course I couldn't read this clipping, but the gentleman who'd brought it to me said it was complimentary, and Nicholas swore it was too. When the first chill nights of fall came on, I wore the fur-lined red cloak on the stage. You could have seen it in the back row of the gallery, even if you were almost blind. I had more skill now with the white makeup, shading it here and there to heighten the contours of my face, and though my eyes were ringed in black, and my lips reddened a little, I looked both startling and human at the same time. I got love notes from the women in the crowd. Nicholas was studying music in the mornings with an Italian maestro, yet we had money enough for good food, wood, and coal. My mother's letters came twice a week and said her health had taken a turn for the better. She wasn't coughing as badly as last winter. She wasn't in pain. But our fathers had disowned us and would not acknowledge any mention of our names. We were too happy to worry about that. But the dark dread, the malady of mortality, was with me a lot when the cold weather came on. The cold seemed worse in Paris. It wasn't clean as it had been in the mountains. The poor hovered in doorways, shivering and hungry. The crooked, unpaved streets were thick with filthy slush. I saw barefoot children suffering before my very eyes, and more neglected corpses lying about than ever before. I was never so glad of the fur-lined cape as I was then. I wrapped it around Nicholas and held him close to me when we went out together, and we walked in a tight embrace through the snow and the rain. Cold or no cold, I can't exaggerate the happiness of these days. Life was exactly what I thought it could be. and I knew I wouldn't be long in Renault's theatre. Everybody was saying so. I had visions of the big stages, of touring London and Italy and even America with a great troupe of actors. Yet there was no reason to hurry. My cup was full. 8. But in the month of October, when Paris was already freezing, I commenced to see quite regularly a strange face in the audience that invariably distracted me. Sometimes it almost made me forget what I was doing, this face. And then it would be gone as if I'd imagined it. I must have seen it off and on for a fortnight before I finally mentioned it to Nicky. I felt foolish and found it hard to put into words. "There is someone out there watching me," I said. "Everyone's watching you," Nicky said. "That's what you want." He was feeling a little sad that evening, and his answer was slightly sharp. Earlier, when he was making the fire, he had said he would never amount to much with a violin. In spite of his ear and his skill, there was too much he didn't know. And I would be a great actor, he was sure. I had said this was nonsense, but it was a shadow falling over my soul. I remembered my mother telling me that it was too late for him. "He wasn't envious," he said. "He was just unhappy a little, that's all." I decided to drop the matter of the mysterious face. I tried to think of some way to encourage him. I reminded him that his playing produced profound emotions in people, that even the actors backstage stopped to listen when he played. He had an undeniable talent. "But I want to be a great violinist," he said, "and I'm afraid it will never be. As long as we were at home, I could pretend that it was going to be." "You can't give up on it," I said. "Lestat, let me be frank with you," he said. "Things are easy for you. What you set your sights on, you get for yourself. I know what you're thinking about all the years you were miserable at home, but even then, what you really set your mind to, you accomplished. And we left for Paris, the very day that you decided to do it." "You don't regret coming to Paris, do you?" I asked. "Of course not. I simply mean that you think things are possible which aren't possible, at least not for the rest of us. Like killing the wolves." A coldness passed over me when he said this, and for some reason I thought of that mysterious face again in the audience, the one watching. Something to do with the wolves, something to do with the sentiments Nicky was expressing, didn't make sense. I tried to shrug it off. "If you'd set out to play the violin, you'd probably be playing for the court by now," he said. "Nicky, this kind of talk is poison," I said under my breath. "You can't do anything but try to get what you want. You knew the odds were against you when you started. There isn't anything else." "Except..." "I know," he smiled. "Except the meaninglessness. Death." "Yes," I said. "All you can do is make your life have meaning. Make it good." "Oh, not goodness again," he said. "You and your malady of mortality, and your malady of goodness." He had been looking at the fire, and he turned to me with a deliberately scornful expression. "We're a pack of actors and entertainers who can't even be buried in consecrated ground. We're outcasts." "God, if you could only believe in it," I said, "that we do good when we make others forget their sorrow, make them forget for a little while that..." "What? That they are going to die?" He smiled in a particularly vicious way. "Lestat, I thought all this would change with you when we got to Paris." "That was foolish of you, Nick," I answered. He was making me angry now. "I do good in the Boulevard du Temple. I feel it." I stopped because I saw the mysterious face again, and a dark feeling had passed over me, something of foreboding. Yet even that startling face was usually smiling. That was the odd thing. Yes, smiling. Enjoying. "Lestat, I love you," Nicky said gravely. "I love you as I have loved few people in my life. But in a real way, you're a fool with all your ideas about goodness." I laughed. "Nicholas," I said, "I can live without God. I can even come to live with the idea there is no life after. But I do not think I could go on if I did not believe in the possibility of goodness. Instead of mocking me for once, why don't you tell me what you believe?"
As I see it, he said, there's weakness and there's strength, and there is good art and bad art, and that is what I believe in. At the moment we are engaged in making what is rather bad art, and it has nothing to do with goodness. Our conversation could have turned into a full-scale fight here if I had said all that was on my mind about bourgeois pomposity, for I fully believed that our work at Renault's was in many ways finer than what I saw at the grand theatres. Only the framework was less impressive. Why couldn't a bourgeois gentleman forget about the frame? How could he be made to look at something other than the surface? I took a deep breath. If goodness does exist, he said, then I'm the opposite of it. I'm evil and I revel in it. I thumb my nose at goodness. And if you must know, I don't play the violin for the idiots who come to Renault's to make them happy. I play it for me, for Nicholas. I didn't want to hear any more. It was time to go to bed. But I was bruised by this little talk, and he knew it. And as I started to pull off my boots, he got up from the chair and came and sat next to me. I'm sorry, he said in the most broken voice. It was so changed from the posture of a minute ago that I looked up at him, and he was so young and so miserable that I couldn't help putting my arm around him and telling him that he must not worry about it any more. You have a radiance in you, Lestat, he said, and it draws everyone to you. It's there even when you're angry or discouraged. Poetry, I said. We're both tired. No, it's true, he said. You have a light in you that's almost blinding. But in me there's only darkness. Sometimes I think it's like the darkness that infected you that night in the inn when you began to cry and to tremble. You were so helpless, so unprepared for it. I tried to keep the darkness from you because I need your light. I need it desperately. But you don't need the darkness. You're the mad one, I said. If you could see yourself, hear your own voice, your music, which of course you play for yourself. You wouldn't see darkness, Nicky. You'd see an illumination that is all your own. Somber, yes, but light and beauty come together in you in a thousand different patterns. The next night the performance went especially well. The audience was a lively one, inspiring all of us to extra tricks. I did some new dance steps that for some reason never proved interesting in private rehearsal, but worked miraculously on the stage. And Nicky was extraordinary with a violin, playing one of his own compositions. But towards the end of the evening I glimpsed the mysterious face again. It jarred me worse than it ever had, and I almost lost the rhythm of my song. In fact, it seemed my head for a moment was swimming. When Nicky and I were alone again, I had to talk about it, about the peculiar sensation that I had fallen asleep on the stage and had been dreaming. We sat by the hearth together with our wine on the top of a little barrel, and in the firelight Nicky looked as weary and dejected as he had the night before. I didn't want to trouble him, but I couldn't forget about the face. "Well, what does he look like?" Nicholas asked. He was warming his hands, and over his shoulder I saw through the window a city of snow-covered rooftops that made me feel more cold. I didn't like this conversation. "That's the worst part of it," I said. "All I see is a face. He must be wearing something black, a cloak and even a hood, but it looks like a mask to me, the face, very white and strangely clear. I mean, the lines in his face are so deep they seemed to be etched with black grease paint. I see it for a moment. It veritably glows. Then when I look again, there's no one there. Yet this is an exaggeration. It's more subtle than that, the way he looks. And yet..." The description seemed to disturb Nicky as much as it disturbed me. He didn't say anything, but his face softened somewhat, as if he were forgetting his sadness. "Well, I don't want to get your hopes up," he said. He was very kind and sincere now. "But maybe it is a mask you're seeing, and maybe it's someone from the Comédie Française come to see you perform." I shook my head. "I wish it was. But no one would wear a mask like that. And I'll tell you something else, too." He waited. But I could see I was passing on to him some of my own apprehension. He reached over and took the wine bottle by the neck and poured a little in my glass. "Whoever he is," I said, He knows about the wolves.
He what?
He knows about the wolves. I was very unsure of myself. It was like recounting a dream I had all but forgotten. He knows I killed the wolves back home. He knows the cloak I wear is lined with their fur.
What are you talking about? You mean you've spoken to him?
No, that's just it, I said. This was so confusing to me, so vague. I felt that swimming sensation again. That's what I'm trying to tell you. I've never spoken to him, never been near him, but he knows.
Ah, Lestat, he said.
He sat back on the bench. He was smiling at me in the most endearing way.
Next you'll be seeing ghosts.
You have the strongest imagination of anyone I've ever known.
There are no ghosts, I answered softly.
I scowled at our little fire. I laid a few more lumps of coal on it. All the humor went out of Nicholas.
How in the hell could he know about the wolves? And how could you...
I told you already. I don't know, I said. I sat thinking and not saying anything, disgusted, maybe, at how ridiculous it all seemed. And then as we remained silent together, and the fire was the only sound or movement in the room, the name Wolf Killer came to me very distinctly, as if someone had spoken it. But nobody had. I looked at Nicky, painfully aware that his lips had never moved, and I think all the blood drained from my face. I felt not the dread of death as I had on so many other nights, but an emotion that was really alien to me. Fear. I was still sitting there, too unsure of myself to say anything, when Nicholas kissed me.
"Let's go to bed," he said softly. Part 2. The Legacy of Magnus.
1. It must have been 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd heard the church bells in my sleep. And like all sensible men in Paris, we had our door barred and our window locked. Not good for a room with a coal fire. But the roof was a path to our window, and we were locked in. I was dreaming of the wolves. I was on the mountain and surrounded, and I was swinging the old medieval flail. Then the wolves were dead again, and the dream was better. Only I had all those miles to walk in the snow. The horse screamed in the snow. My mare turned into a loathsome insect, half smashed on the stone floor. A voice said, "Wolf killer," long and low, a whisper that was like a summons and a tribute at the same time. I opened my eyes, or I thought I did, and there was someone standing in the room, a tall, bent figure with its back to the little hearth. Embers still glowed on the hearth. The light moved upwards, etching the edges of the figure clearly, then dying out before it reached the shoulders, the head. But I realized I was looking right at the white face I'd seen in the audience at the theatre, and my mind opening, sharpening, realized the room was locked, that Nicholas lay beside me, that this figure stood over our bed. I heard Nicholas's breathing. I looked into the white face.
"Wolf killer," came the voice again.
But the lips hadn't moved, and the figure drew nearer, and I saw that the face was no mask. Black eyes, quick and calculating black eyes, and white skin, and some appalling smell coming from it, like the smell of mouldering clothes in a damp room. I think I rose up, or perhaps I was lifted, because in an instant I was standing on my feet. The sleep was slipping off me like garments. I was backing up into the wall. The figure had my red cloak in its hands. Desperately I thought of my sword. My muskets, they were under the bed, on the floor. And the thing thrust the red cloak towards me, and then, through the fur-lined velvet, I felt its hand close on the lapel of my coat. I was torn forward. I was drawn off my feet across the room. I shouted for Nicholas. I screamed, "Nicky! Nicky!" as loud as I could. I saw the partially opened window, and then suddenly the glass burst into thousands of fragments and the wooden frame was broken out. I was flying over the alleyway, 6 stories above the ground. I screamed. I kicked at this thing that was carrying me. Caught up in the red cloak, I twisted, trying to get loose. But we were flying over the rooftop, and now going up the straight surface of a brick wall. I was dangling in the arm of the creature, and then very suddenly, on the surface of a high place, I was thrown down. I lay for a moment, seeing Paris spread out before me in a great circle, the white snow, and chimney pots, and church belfries, and the lowering sky. And then I rose up, stumbling over the fur-lined cloak, and I started to run. I ran to the edge of the roof and looked down. Nothing but a sheer drop of hundreds of feet, and then to another edge, and it was exactly the same. I almost fell. I turned, desperate, panting. We were on the top of some square tower, no more than 50 feet across, and I could see nothing higher in any direction, and the figure stood staring at me. And I heard come out of it a low, rasping laughter, just like the whisper before. "Wolf killer," it said again. "Damn you," I shouted. "Who the hell are you?" And in a rage I flew at it with my fists. It didn't move. I struck it as if I was striking the brick wall. I veritably bounced off it, losing my footing in the snow and scrambling up and attacking it again. Its laughter grew louder and louder, and deliberately mocking, but with a strong undercurrent of pleasure that was even more maddening than the mockery. I ran to the edge of the tower and then turned on the creature again. "What do you want with me?" I demanded. "Who are you?" And when it gave nothing but this maddening laughing, I went for it again. But this time I went for the face and the neck, and I made my hands like claws to do it, and I pulled off the hood and saw the creature's black hair and the full shape of its human-looking head, soft skin. Yet it was as immovable as before. It backed up a little, raising its arms to play with me, to push me back and forth as a man would push a little child. Too fast for my eyes, it moved its face away from me, turning to one side and then the other, and all of these movements with seeming effortlessness, as I frantically tried to hurt it and could feel nothing but that soft, white skin sliding under my fingers and maybe once or twice its fine black hair. "Brave, strong little wolf-killer," it said to me now, in a rounder, deeper voice. I stopped, panting and covered with sweat, staring at it and seeing the details of its face, the deep lines I had only glimpsed in the theatre, its mouth drawn up in a jester's smile. "Oh, God, help me, help me," I said as I backed away. It seemed impossible that such a face should move, show expression, and gaze with such affection on me as it did. "God!"
"What God is that, wolf-killer?" it asked.
I turned my back on it and let out a terrible roar. I felt its hands close on my shoulders like things forged of metal, and as I went into a last frenzy of struggling, it whipped me around so that its eyes were right before me, wide and dark, and the lips were closed yet still smiling, and then it bent down, and I felt the prick of its teeth on my neck. Out of all the childhood tales, the old fables, the name came to me, like a drowned thing shooting to the surface of black water and breaking free in the light. "Vampire!" I gave one last frantic cry, shoving at the creature with all I had. Then there was silence. Stillness. I knew that we were still on the roof. I knew that I was being held in the thing's arms. Yet it seemed we had risen, become weightless. We're travelling through the darkness even more easily than we had travelled before. "Yes, yes," I wanted to say, "exactly." And a great noise was echoing all around me, enveloping me, the sound of a deep gong, perhaps, being struck very slowly in perfect rhythm, its sound washing through me so that I felt the most extraordinary pleasure through all my limbs. My lips moved, but nothing came out of them. Yet this didn't really matter. All the things I had ever wanted to say were clear to me, and that is what mattered, not that they be expressed. And there was so much time, so much sweet time in which to say anything and do anything. There was no urgency at all. Rapture, I said the word, and it seemed clear to me, that one word, though I couldn't speak or really move my lips, and I realized I was no longer breathing. Yet something was making me breathe. It was breathing for me, and the breaths came with the rhythm of the gong, which was nothing to do with my body, and I loved it, the rhythm, the way that it went on, and I no longer had to breathe or speak or know anything. My mother smiled at me, and I said, "I love you," to her, and she said, "Yes, always loved, always loved." And I was sitting in the monastery library, and I was 12 years old, and the monk said to me, "A great scholar," and I opened all the books and could read everything, Latin, Greek, French. The illuminated letters were indescribably beautiful, and I turned around and faced the audience in Renault's theatre, and saw all of them on their feet, and a woman moved the painted fan from in front of her face, and it was Marie Antoinette. She said, "Wolf killer," and Nicholas was running towards me, crying for me to come back. His face was full of anguish, his hair was loose, and his eyes were rimmed with blood. He tried to catch me. I said, "Nicky, get away from me," and I realized, in agony, positive agony, that the sound of the gong was fading away. I cried out. I begged. "Don't stop it, please, please. I don't want to. I don't. Please."
"Leliot, the wolf killer," said the thing,
and it was holding me in its arms, and I was crying because the spell was breaking. "Don't! Don't!" I was heavy all over. My body had come back to me with its aches and its pains and my own choking cries, and I was being lifted, thrown upwards, until I fell over the creature's shoulder and I felt its arm around my knees. I wanted to say, "God protect me." I wanted to say it with every particle of me, but I couldn't say it, and there was the alleyway below me again, that drop of hundreds of feet, and the whole of Paris tilted at an appalling angle, and there was the snow and the searing wind. 2. I was awake, and I was very thirsty. I wanted a great deal of very cold white wine, the way it is when you bring it up out of the cellar in autumn. I wanted something fresh and sweet to eat, like a ripe apple. It did occur to me that I had lost my reason, though I couldn't have said why. I opened my eyes and knew it was early evening. The light might have been morning light, but too much time had passed for that. It was evening, and through a wide, heavily barred stone window I saw hills and woods, blanketed with snow, and the vast, tiny collection of rooftops and towers that made up the city far away. I hadn't seen it like this since the day I came in the post-carriage. I closed my eyes, and the vision of it remained as if I'd never opened my eyes at all. But it was no vision. It was there, and the room was warm in spite of the window. There had been a fire in the room. I could smell it, but the fire had gone out. I tried to reason, but I couldn't stop thinking about cold white wine and apples in the basket. I could see the apples. I felt myself drop down out of the branches of the tree, and I smelled all around me the freshly cut grass. The sunlight was blinding on the green fields. It shone on Nicholas's brown hair and on the deep lacquer of the violin. The music climbed up to the soft, rolling clouds, and against the sky I saw the battlements of my father's house. Battlements. I opened my eyes again, and I knew I was lying in a high tower room several miles from Paris. And just in front of me, on a crude little wooden table, was a bottle of cold white wine, precisely as I had dreamed it. For a long time I looked at it. Looked at the frost of droplets covering it, and I could not believe it possible to reach for it and drink. Never had I known the thirst I was suffering now. My whole body thirsted, and I was so weak, and I was getting a little cold. The room moved when I moved. The sky gleamed in the window. And when at last I did reach for the bottle and pull the cork from it and smell the tart, delicious aroma, I drank and drank without stopping, not caring what would happen to me or where I was or why the bottle had been set here. My head swung forward. The bottle was almost empty, and the faraway city was vanishing in the black sky, leaving a little sea of lights behind it. I put my hands to my head. The bed on which I'd been sleeping was no more than stone.